Sorry, we had to break. I kind of had to insert a break there. Yeah. And you and your colleague.
So we, I think this whole thing probably, again, for me at least, comes out of boredom. I just felt, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I would say it's not really absolutely boredom, but in some sense, I felt like I've been in microtubules. I've been reading about microtubules, studying cell division for all these years. All the problems I know is there, and some problems it would be really great to crack, but it's going to take time to crack. And conceptually, I don't think there's anything novel there. And there's no huge paradigm resetting ahead of me. At least I'm not smart enough to think that way. So I kind of felt, oh, it's all the same thing. I mean, it's all filling the details. So I was getting sort of not fired up anymore, and that was always dangerous for me because when I feel bored, I just want to quit.
Okay.
So now I start to read, and I felt, well, what's there left that there probably still could be new things one could think of. I have to say, I felt like throughout my research career, all I did wasn't, it was just basically, it's good, but nothing is that exciting. So I wanted to do something really unknown, you know, start from somewhere that's really, there's a lot of unknown. So the first thing, one thing that had always attracted me was the eukaryotic evolution. If you think about how eukaryotic, different from prokaryotic system, it's just amazing. The differences are amazing. And then how nature made that huge leap is a big question in evolution. I've been reading something like that.
Yeah.
So I felt, well, you know, I've been doing cell biology for all these years. Maybe my background could be suitable to allow me to do something that's different, completely different. So initially I thought about maybe, you know, one way you could create this evolution of a eukaryotic system is maybe, you know, organisms, well, that's actually not my idea. It's something I read, but I sort of, you know, implemented on that is you could, for example, put the archaea, which is one kingdom,
mm-hmm.
that sort of people felt has a lot, shared a lot of characteristics with eukaryotes, but also, mm-hmm. also with bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if you could fuse archaea with bacteria, then you might end up getting something. You might drive evolution. You might get somewhere. So I was excited about that for a while, but then I realized archaea, the system of whole archaea study has not been developed very well. So for me, who have no background, it's going to be hard. I also had no background in bacteria study. So I felt, well, you know, let's just not be too ambitious. That's fusing kingdoms. Let's just step back. And then I read more about yeast, and I started to realize actually in yeast there are a lot of naturally occurring hybrids that people use in beer brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a hybrid of Cerevisiae, which is the baker's yeast, and then another species of Saccharomyces. It's called Bayanus. So mm-hmm. I thought, well, if we fuse them together, we may get something. And also, if you read plant literature, a lot of plants are evolved by, you know, if you cross two species of plant together, you can see immediate new traits, new features coming out, and people have been studying that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Barbara McClintock had this idea about so-called, I think she's calling it cytoshock.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bring two cytoplasm together where they have not seen each other for many years, they've been separated, you will create stimulations or certain new traits, induce certain new gene expression or new changes, and that will give you new features. So I thought, well, plant is really slow going, studying plants, maybe yeast is good. So I got together with my colleague, Dan Kashlan. So we've been doing studies along those lines, but it's slow going, and it's sort of nice to have something that you can, I myself, work on and, you know, read something that's quite different. I've been reading quite a lot of evolution papers and thinking along those lines. I think it's quite stimulating, and that kept me going with doing research.
Yeah. Well, where do you think your greatest contributions are going to come from? Is it, you know, intellectually and conceptualizing new directions, or is it you've also have a track record for having overcome a lot of technological barriers?
Yeah, I never felt I'm a technical person. In fact, I think I'm very good at using techniques to solve a problem that I'm interested in, but I'm not good at creating new techniques. I think my strength is more like in that I tend to see connections where the connections aren't that obvious to most people. I tend to sort of look at things that sort of on the borderline that may join two different fields. RAM is one example. I mean, in fact, it was really funny. When I was considering RAN, I also was considering another project. I had a new postdoc coming in. I thought, well, I want this postdoc to work on something different from gamma tubulin. So I had tried to seek advice from people in my field. I told them about these two ideas. And, you know, I remember very clearly, in general, people liked my other idea, which is much more conventional, much more, you know, obvious, whereas they felt RAN was really kind of oddball. You know, people have known RAN is involved in so many things. How do you know? You know, RAN would be just a direct regulator or indirect regulator. So I think that's where I tend to. I mean, especially after I had my own lab, I've been able to sort of look at things and see connections that wasn't that obvious. And the spindle disassembly project is a similar thing. I mean, we study this my student land on this complex, and it took me 2 months to figure out it could be involved in that. And this complex had been known for a long time for being involved in membrane function. So we now linked it to also in regulating microtubule, the spindle disassembly. So I think that's probably is where I'm reasonably good at.
Yeah. And how do you decide when to pursue a tangent, when to pursue what the obvious next experiments, and when to start off in new directions?
I think it's complicated factors. You know, if a person in my lab already has a good publication that, you know, they just need another publication, then in that case, I feel like they should just follow the obvious next thing to do and then, you know, finish up their training. I think if it's a new person who just came in, I tend to get them to explore more. Almost all new postdocs I have, I always hope that they will find something different. But most of the time, end up being going back to the same, you know, more reliable things to do. I wish science is something that, you know, people don't count on how many papers you publish, how frequently you publish. They just look at how important your findings are. If that's the case, then we can all just follow our own dreams. But that's not the real world.
Okay, what is the real world?
The real world, I think I live in a very nice world. It's a real world, but it's nicer than a lot of other people. Being at Carnegie, well, first of all, I don't have teaching.
Okay.
So that gives me a lot of extra time to think and to do things myself. And also, there's this idea, intellectual interest or the tradition of trying to do something different. You know, we all feel we should do, really do some, take some risk. And I think we, I think at least this is the sense I have, that if I decide I'm going to explore something, and even if I lose my grant for 2 or 3 years, I would be okay here. That's my sense, but I don't know if that's really true because I've never tested it, but that's the sense I have. Although I have to say I'm not brave enough to do that.
I would say many Pew scholars would have told stories of, you know, the publish or perish kind of model of science.
Yeah.
And how much pressure do you feel?
I feel a fair amount of pressure. I mean, we all have to publish. But I never really felt I have to publish really prolifically. I felt like, well, with a lab size of fluctuating between 6 to 9, and mostly around 7, if I can publish 2 papers a year, I'm doing pretty well. But those publications has to be very solid.
Yeah. How do you assess your publication record?
In what way?
Have you been successful?
I think I publish reasonably well, but I wouldn't say I'm very prolific.
Okay.
I think my number of publication is probably above average. Definitely not first class number in terms of the number.
Right.
But I think the quality I publish, I feel good about it. I feel, you know, we publish really solid work, and we publish complete story, and we also publish novel findings, and that's what I think is important.
Mm-hmm. Well, where do you see your work going in 5 and then 10 years from now?
So in 5 years, I really would like to be able to know some underlying mechanisms of, you know, how spindle really form, how it really become a bipolar orientation from a monopolar orientation. That's one thing I would really like to know. And then with respect to centrosome assembly, I would really like to be able to learn more about how gamma tubulin is recruited to the centrosome and what regulates that recruitment. That's my 5-year goal. And in 2 years, I really hope I would be able to make some breakthrough in my evolutionary project. And I really hope I would be able to establish some system where you can really study how the cell might evolve new traits by combining different species or GNRE, what's that called? Well, anyway, just combining distant organisms and see what the impact of that would be in terms of generating new traits, and also maybe developing some way of actually studying it. And that's my 10-year plan. Probably would never happen. Maybe next year I'll say, oh, I'm giving up on that.
Yeah. Okay, well, will you still be in cell biology or...
Yeah, I think I would always be in cell biology. Cell biology is a very broad field.
Yes, okay.
Anything you study requires cell biology. You know, ultimately how we function all is determined at the cellular basis. So cell biology is very important. So I think I would still be a cell biologist, even if I, in the end, if I'm lucky enough to be able to develop something in evolution, in being able to understand certain things in evolution, I think one feature would still be cell biology. But it might actually not be microtubules. It might become something different in cell biology.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about, your competition and how competitive your field is. And I'll just bring up, one example that kind of the story has been told now, but at one time there was a couple of different theories about what how microtubule nucleation, a couple of models, and it was yours, that it is the first turn of the microtubule helix, and then there was another lab who was kind of arguing for a pro-filament model, and you have kind of, with with your own research, have kind of answered that. But how in terms of conceptualizing what's trying to go, what's happening in microtubule assembly, how different are these competing theories?
It's quite different.
Right.
It's quite different. It's just basically 90-degree different.
Right, right.
I'm pretty confident our model is correct.
Right.
But I do have to say the other model has some very unique features. So really, I think what's going to solve that is going to be structural work.
Yeah.
I think if we could really see how gamma tubulin is sitting in the ring, and how gamma tubulin is sitting at the end of microtubules, that will really settle that business. Although we did sort of show gamma tubulin, my work and also Dave Eggert's work, have shown that gamma tubulin sit flush at the end of microtubules. There's still, you know, some doubts because you sometimes can also see it hangs like that.
Okay.
So it's still very controversial. But if you really can improve that structural work where you can quantify how what percentage is sitting end on, what percentage is sitting like that, and also show that gamma tubulin is actually sitting upside, it's sitting up instead of laying down, I think that would probably help. Yeah. I think it's going to be more structural work than the work that we will be able to contribute.
And in your field, how high are the stakes that there are these competing theories and somebody...
Well, I have to say, it's really interesting. I think gamma tubulin and centrosome field is really not that competitive,
okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's just too hard. You spend years and years and years, you may get one paper. And that paper might even be something you are not so excited about. So I don't think there's a whole lot of competition, mostly because it's just too hard. And in fact, I think people in our field have begun to realize that and have become much more supportive of each other. Because it's so hard, if you hold the same standard as some field that move really fast, then essentially we cannot publish. So I think people in the same field have been changing attitude to help so that this field won't die.
Okay.
Otherwise it will die. If you hold
because.
This, because it's just too hard. If you decide you are making a career in this field, if people are having the same standard as the fast-moving field, then they would expect you to publish same number of papers, the same quality papers, the same big steps.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, you would have no publication, and then results in no grant, then die. I that's how I see it. I think people just have to be more understanding it from the perspective of the field itself.
And how optimistic are you that this field will, you know, continue to get support?
It will. I think it will, but I think it will also take the effort of people in the field to really be supportive of each other to have that happen.
So would you define your field more as collaborative in nature or competitive in nature?
I think it's just really small. I'm not sure how to... I mean, I don't think it's competitive in the way I see it. I think in the beginning it was competitive, like when I was purifying Gamma Turk. I was competing with somebody in my field. I mean, we end up, after many years, we end up being okay. We're fine, we're still communicating. I think we really have a fine relationship. I think the reason that was being competitive is, you know, it's an obvious thing to do. You just have to get it done, right? But now, you know, there are so many molecules you could study, so you don't have to all study one molecule. I don't think it's that competitive.
No.
I really don't feel... I feel like there is a sense of more people leaving it.
Oh, okay.
This is how I feel. People sort of trying to figure out a different way to do it. Maybe it's just trying to figure out a different way from a different angle. I don't know.
And where do they go to if they leave this field?
Well, still in microtubules.
Okay.
You're still in microtubules, but you sort of take a view that's further away.
Okay.
I don't know, I may be wrong, but my sense is it's been very difficult. And I felt, you know, based on I see how it, what it takes to get your NIH grant renewed, I felt if we all just been stubborn and stick in here and then try to just make something that hasn't worked for many years to work, you probably will have to experience it losing your grant.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, some other people from other field would have developed something. Then they will come in to fix, to do, to answer certain questions. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah. So how do you keep yourself moving away from unboring, or away from boring science, and doing the kind of science that you don't think is boring? And how do you train students to do unboring, to use a, I think, a Volkswagen term, or IKEA, maybe it's IKEA, unboring science?
Well, I think it's boring or not boring, it's all personal. I just, to me, it's boring or not boring. I think I just, if there's something new there that's not, you have already read or somebody had already said, then that's excite me. And if I'm studying something, somebody already predicted it, then I think it's really boring. And so that's why I think if I have new students coming, I never have them work on something that, oh, people showed this in here, in this system, let's try to see if it works in this system. I just consider that, no. I want students to really look at the literature and see what is already known, and then what they can go from there to something that's unknown, the next, at least the next interesting question, instead of just, you know, say, well, this is also true in my system. That's I think that's the minimum. I think the best would be a student comes in and say, well, I have an idea, you hear me out, and this has never been considered, and then we think about it and go after that. That would be the best. But the second best would be, based on your reading, what's the next most important question? Is this question solved? If it's not, let's see if we could do something about it.
Well, where do new ideas come from? From these, you know, people that don't have a lot of experience, you know, that are new to the lab.
I think it's a combination of interactions. I think postdocs who have been successful with me have, in the end, when they publish something, it's always something they, as a researcher, had a keen eye to notice the phenomena. If it's just me saying, okay, this is a good direction, let's go after this, and you will be okay, it would never have worked. They have to be the one to really not only understand this profoundly, and also have the eye to see, ooh, this is really interesting. We better follow this up or come up with some idea, and then we discuss. I think that's how it's going to work. And that's how it always have worked. A person who just basically have no spark in themselves would never work. That's just my experience. I don't necessarily think you have to have somebody coming in with all the bells and whistles all complete, but they do have to have their own in that, in observing, in doing experiments, in thinking. And then you sort of facilitate that along the line. Maybe most people come to my lab so far sort of are not from the same field. So in the beginning, I need to train them. I need to tell them what are the baselines, the boundaries of this field, and what are interesting questions, what we could try. But once they get a hang of it, eventual observation, which lead to a nice finding, usually come from them. Because I'm not the one doing experiment day in and day out. They have to be the one. If they see something exciting, they have to be able to recognize it. And in order to recognize it, they have to have the basic understanding of what they are doing.
Right. Well, my question just ran out of my head. Yesterday you had mentioned it was fate. that, you know, you were bound and determined not to do what your parents did, but, you know, then you end up coming to the United States and really getting involved in science and deciding to make it your career. Are good scientists born, or are they made?
Well,
is it fate, or is it serendipity?
I think science attracts certain personalities. That's something I strongly believe. I think it has a feature of attracting people who likes to really think a lot, and likes to ask questions, and likes to do new things all the time. I think that's what science attracts. I think this is the reason I can settle with it, because it makes me feel every day I go in, I can do something new, or I continue with something that will lead me to something that's new. And it's not same old, every day. I think that's what this characterizes science and probably scientists. I bet most scientists probably have the same tendency as I do. Like, you just can't be bored. If you are bored easily, you better have a career that will occupy your mind. Otherwise, you go crazy.
Well, I think we've come to a good point to stop.
Okay,
today.
Good.
Thanks.